each beginning, it's just, it's that promise of like what is to come. You know, it's not tarnished. It still has all that hope and promise.
What pulls all of my first experiences, the thresholds that I've had career-wise, is memories of unconditional fear.
So first day shooting Portlandia, I realized when I got onto set that I was the boss. I think that's a weird feeling.
A first talent show that I did, which was really pathetic. I sang There Was Nothing Like a Dame.
Well, maybe that's why I don't have a boyfriend. I'm always like, the beginnings of things are great. And then you're like, this is a bit of work.
Yes, it is. And this is the very first day of our new show, Press Play. It's really exciting and also, frankly, a little scary. So I wanted to talk to other people who've started big projects in front of a lot of people, and I asked them to remember some of their firsts. Carrie Brownstein is a musician. She plays in groups like Slater Kinney and Wild Flag, and she's really no stranger to being on stage. But she told me she was terrified on her first day of shooting her TV show, Portlandia.
So first day shooting Portlandia, I realized when I got onto set that I was the boss. I think that's a weird feeling. I mean, you might be able to relate to this. So I don't know. I made it through the first day. I didn't sleep. Another thing I did that year, and maybe since you live in California, you're also susceptible to this. The first day I was wearing a natural deodorant. Switched to something toxic. Switched to something really intense. That's my biggest advice for embarking on something new. Get rid of all natural products you have that are claiming to do things and start using the stuff that will kill you early, but will work.
Speaking of work and making it work, I was beyond excited to talk to Tim Gunn of Project Runway fame.
Oh, Madeline, I have a common denominator. I don't know how happy you're going to be with the common denominator, but for me, these thresholds that are so profound, what ties them all together for me is memories of unconditional fear, terror.
Oh my gosh.
Truly.
So tell me, what is it like for you then when you have this terror and then you just work through it? And then you're doing it, and then does the terror dissipate, or
it
what
does.
Happens?
It you just have to work through it. I still remember the first time that I taught. And I had been an assistant teacher, so I'd been in a classroom, but I wasn't the person in charge. And the first time that I taught, I thought, I mean, I'll tell you, I'll be honest with you, I would throw up before each class for a solid week. And I would have to brace my body, my whole body, head to toe against a wall, because my knees were shaking so badly. If I were to step away from the wall, I would just collapse onto the floor. So I went to my mentor, a wonderful woman by the name of Rona Slade, and I said, what am I going to do? I mean, I've become a dysfunctional person. And she said, I'm familiar with this malady. She said, well, I trust that this is either going to kill you or cure you, and I'm trusting on the latter.
Clearly and thankfully, it was the latter. So nerves, everyone gets them, even legendary punk rockers. Although for John Doe of the band X, his nervousness on stage started when he was really little.
A first talent show that I did, which was really pathetic.
What was that?
It was in third grade. It was in Baltimore. I had just moved there the year before. I put my hand up, and we had to walk down the hall, and I went into the cafeteria, and there were three teachers there, and there's a bunch of other kids, and I sang There Was Nothing Like a Dame, which must have been completely hilarious.
For a third grader.
You know, and they said at the very end, now can't you just do something to show that you're finished? And I kind of put my hands out a la Tony Bennett, I suppose. And then I cried all the way back to the classroom because I thought I had bombed so badly. But I got in the talent show, and my first performance was with a girl named Michelle, last name I can't remember, and we sang I Love You, A Bushel and a Peck.
Oh, that's so sweet.
So there goes all of my punk rock cred, Madeline. Thanks very much.
Speaking of Los Angeles, Mayor Eric Garcetti shared a story when he, too, was a little boy. And it also involves a song.
A
If I weren't in politics, I might be in music. And so my significant first was the first song that I ever wrote. I was 7 years old, maybe six or seven, and there was a competition for the Yamaha School of Music that I was attending to write a song. And so I wrote a song just entitled Soap. So I thought I might sing it because I still remember the words. It goes, soap helps to make you clean. It is blue, yellow, or green. It will still make you clean, even if you're a king or queen. Written by Eric Garcetti, 6 years old, still with me. You know, I got very lucky, there was hundreds of kids who submitted songs, and I actually won the grand prize for that song. I guess Soap was really big back then, and it was the first competition I won. I certainly learned that later on in life, you don't win them all the time, and I went through all sorts of things from student council elections to other things that I've entered where I have come in, you know, probably dead last. But it showed me that you've got to put yourself out there. You've got to be creative. Sing from the heart no matter what you do, and you might just win.
All the people I spoke to, they're all really successful in their fields, but none has created a radio show from scratch. So I called up someone who has.
From WBEZ Chicago and Public Radio International, it's This American Life. I'm Ira Glass.
Hi, Ira.
Hey, Madeline. I mean, I remember when we started our radio show, and I remember working all the time. Like, literally any time that I was awake, I was at work. And I remember I was several years into this because we were a staff of four people doing what now 12 of us do, okay?
Oh, my gosh.
And I ran into Scott Simon somewhere, and I'd remembered when he started his show. And I told him, I'm in this situation where I'm just working every waking minute. I was like, how long is that going to last? And he thought for a second, and he said 5 years.
What did you think when he said that?
It seemed horrible.
Yeah.
But I was relieved to know that it had an end. So I brought something to our interview that I haven't heard in a really long time. And knowing what we were going to talk about, this is the very first story I ever put on the radio. And the date of this story, the broadcast date, was June 29th, 1980.
Oh, my gosh.
And I don't know if it's good or bad, and I can play it for you.
Okay.
And I want to preface this by saying a couple of things. Can I?
Yeah.
Okay. I was bad for a really long time before I was any good.
Uh-huh.
And so this really might be during the bad period. And another thing is that if this is 1980, so I'm 21 when I did this. Okay, you ready?
Yeah.
This ran on All Things Considered.
Okay,
so I'm just going to play this and we can stop and start it.
Okay.
As it goes. I'm playing this off of a cassette that I wasn't even sure if it was going to play. Okay, here we go. Here's the piece.
All Things Considered. The ad read, "Calling all apes. If you're an undiscovered actor and want to be an anonymous ape, bring a resume and a photo to the University of Maryland Student Center." Reporter Ira Glass went to the auditions for Beyond the Planet of the Apes.
Diane Hammett, a student in veterinary medicine, decided to make this unofficial sequel to Planet of the Apes after she designed a new kind of non-cracking mold for the ape makeup. She's putting $15,000 of her own money into...
Okay, just a little tip if you're going to be on the radio. Don't emphasize every other word.
Also, I love your voice. It's very... You're trying to modulate to Noah Adams' really deep voice there.
It sounds like I'm trying to be a person on All Things Considered, right?
Right, it does. Yeah.
Fine.
For a feature-length movie, which means that none of the 138 would-be apes at the audition will get paid.
That doesn't matter. I'm going to do it because I love acting.
Look at the apes that were in 2001. Those were actors. There's probably some of the finest acting in the last 20 years on film.
How do you play an ape? Most people at the audition took that question very seriously.
When there are any ape makes...
Can I just say, I hear my own actual performance style in this, like, thing. Like, the way I just performed, how do you play an ape? It's like, I'm going to perform it for you now as me today. It's going to sound exactly the same. How do you play an ape? Oh, you see, no, that was different.
No, totally different.
I'm going to roll back, because where are we?
How do you play an ape? Most people at the audition...
Madeline, how do you play an ape? Most of the people at the audition had their own theories, Madeline.
In the last 20 years.
You know what occurred to me the other day? Is that like 200 people, I can't remember the exact number, just an absurd number of people applied to be what we used to call the intern on our show, but now we call it the fellow because we were hiring such unbelievably overqualified people. Like literally the last person we hired to be our intern came to us. She was a reporter at NBC News.
Oh my God.
And and we're just like, we can't call you an intern anymore. Yeah. And it occurred to me when I was starting off in radio, I could have applied to be an intern to my own show now and I wouldn't have gotten it. Like I could not have been an intern at This American Life.
Would you, as yourself now, if you had heard that, how do you play an ape, would you have just chucked that cassette into the garbage and said, forget it, I'm never going to hire this guy?
Probably, yeah. Yeah. Well, if that were all, I have to say, some of the quotes here aren't so bad. let's keep going.
Okay.
And there's probably some of the finest acting in the last 20 years on film.
How do you play an ape? Most people at the audition took that question very seriously.
When they're in the ape makeup, they have to project a little bit more for you. It's almost like stage work, but you just simply have to project to get past all that foam.
The slouch. The only thing I really have is the eyes to give a lot of the expression. The eyes and, of course, body movements.
The lightly rolling walk.
Trying to apply my character and seeing things from an ape's point of view.
A hesitancy.
Go study one. Go down to the National Zoo and watch.
A certain twitchiness.
An evolved ape, he's going to stand more erect. So you got to do your homework. And if he's sort of a lower ape, he's going to be more squat to the ground.
Ability to not stand perfectly still.
Olivier says he starts with the costume. Find that the right handkerchief or the right glove.
Or the right paw.
Or the right paw. Or the left paw.
To be an ape is something that's innate.
Come on, Madeline.
Wait, I really like this. Can I just say, and I'm not just saying that to flatter you, I really do. I'm listening intently.
I am shocked.
Maybe you should hire that guy as your intern. He's got some potential.
Or the left paw.
To be an ape is something that's innate and natural inside of us because we came from apes, right?
The actors may be on the wrong track with all their theories about aping apes. Director Jeff Canfield said his primary criterion for choosing the 21 best actors was much simpler.
Mostly I look for physical size when it comes to the apes. Shorter people and women, even as male apes, all the way up to the very tall people for gorillas.
Like the film's producers, most actors at the audition were just looking for some film experience and for that distant possibility of a break in Hollywood.
It would be a film credit. So, I don't care what I have to play out there.
You want to be an ape?
No, not really. I want to be a star.
For National Public Radio, I'm Ira Glass.
He's got arms like legs. He's got hands on his feet.
I am so surprised that was decent. I am stunned. Madeline, I think I have a future in this business.
I would definitely hire you as my intern, Ira Glass.
Can I just say, my parents are the only Jews in America who don't like public radio, and they opposed this career path for a really long time. And I hear this, and I've always thought, it's because my stories were bad. And now I hear this story, my very first one.
Ira, thank you. That was really fun, actually. Thanks for sharing that with us.
That was really enjoyable, and I never would have listened to this ever again if it hadn't been for this. So thanks for letting me do it.
That's Ira Glass of This American Life. Okay, so maybe when I go back and listen to this first show 34 years from now, I'll be pleasantly surprised. A dear friend who's also one of my radio heroes wrote me an email Friday with the subject line, "Breathe." And then in the email itself, he wrote, "It's just a radio program. You already know how to do it." I do, but it still feels like the first time.
Feels like the first time. Feels like the very first time. It feels like the first time.
Really, any excuse to play some Foreigner here on KCRW. Coming up on the program, the Oakland Raiderettes don't really have a lot to cheer about. They are suing the Oakland Raiders for not paying them enough money. That's coming up next on Press Play.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more, all in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
You're listening to Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, do you think the life of an NFL cheerleader is all glamorous fun? For some, there is a dark side. Low wages, long rehearsals with no meal breaks, mandatory hair coloring, among other things. These are just a few of the allegations in a lawsuit filed against the Oakland Raiders by the Raiderette cheerleaders. And joining me now is the lead plaintiff. Her name is Lacey T, and we're withholding her last name because it's customary to do so to avoid unwanted fan attention. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you.
All right, so tell us, when did you start as a Raiderette cheerleader, and was this something that you had always dreamed of doing?
Yeah, this was my first season as a Raiderette, and yeah, it's definitely an opportunity that I wanted for a very long time. I have a big passion for dance and performing. I always wanted to dance in the NBA and the NFL, so after dancing in the NBA, it was my next big life goal to get out there on the football field and dance for the Oakland Raiders.
All right. And so tell us about the day-to-day realities of your job. What do you do every day?
The day-to-day realities, well, first of all, when you're on a team in the NFL, there's a certain lifestyle that you have to maintain. You know, we have to be a certain size. We have to look a certain way to be able to step foot out on the field every home game. So on a day-to-day basis, it's definitely a big commitment, but a fun one. I mean, we meet three times a week. We have really long, hard practices. It is very fun. You get to dance with all your friends, and you bond. You get to go out in the community and do tons of events. There's so many positive and happy memories I have from being a Raiderette. But the harsh reality is, and it's time for it to be exposed, is that it's very, very expensive to be an NFL cheerleader, at least for the Oakland Raiders. There were so many things they demanded from us, and it was all out of pocket.
Like, what are some of those things? Can you tell us, give us an example?
Sure. Sure. So at the very beginning of the season, they give you your look. And if your look happens to be a different color than your hair, or if they ask you to get extensions or, you know, change major things about your hair, you're responsible for taking care of that on the monthly basis and maintaining that look and color.
And you pay for it.
Yeah, unfortunately, in the Bay Area, to go get your hair done is extremely expensive. And we do have a sponsor who gave us a 50% discount. But with that 50% discount, I've spent on my hair, even touch-ups, over $100.
Okay, and so that's one example of the expenses. And what's your pay?
So our pay in our contract at the very beginning of the year, it tells us the only thing that we will be paid for are the 10 home games that we perform at, $125 a game, and our end-of-the-year salary, which we'll get when the season's completely over, is expected to be $1,250.
And you have to do a lot more than that. As you said, you have to do appearances and things like that, of that
right.
nature, and rehearsals.
They do require 10 charity appearances. If you want to audition for the next season, you have to complete 10 charity appearances. So that is money and time out of your own pocket. And, you know, time that you volunteer, I mean, they require you to volunteer.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
At 10 different events.
All right. So let me bring in your lawyer now. It's Leslie Levy. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
All right. So as Lacey said, she did sign a contract. Is it a legal contract?
No, actually, it is not a legal contract. And one of the things that we find interesting is that given the battery of lawyers that the Raiders and the NFL have, that they would dare to put in front of these women a contract that contained so many blatantly illegal provisions in it that we have no doubt that the court will invalidate it almost in its entirety.
What is blatantly illegal in the contract?
Well, for instance, refusing to pay them for practices, making them spend money out of pocket that should be a business expense that's reimbursed. They state they're not supposed to talk about their pay with anybody, which is illegal in California. But one of the most appalling pieces in the contract is that they start work in April. They receive their one and only paycheck in January. So for 9 months, they don't get paid anything for any of the work that they're doing.
And yet they say, and let me just note that we reached out to them for comment. They have not returned our calls for comment, and they have told other media outlets that they're not going to comment on this lawsuit, the Raiders themselves. But, you know, it's well known that this is a desirable job, that hundreds of women apply for very few positions. It's very desirable. Why would that be if the conditions are so bad?
Well, I think it's desirable. It's you know, fun to be out there, as Lacey put it. It takes a lot of hard work. I think that they are the women are intimidated and pressured not to say anything about how they get paid. One of the carrots they hold is that this is a great opportunity to get into TV and modeling, which of course happens for hardly any of them. But regardless, it is work, and they should be getting paid minimum wage, and they should be getting paid according to law. And if you follow the line of reasoning, then any job that people want, any job that's desirable, any job that you have fun at, it's okay if you don't get paid in accordance with the law. There's no reason that that should be an exception.
Right, right. And so they are adding value in terms of monetary value. They're not just eye candy, if you will, and it's not just a silly frivolity. They actually provide monetary value to the team, right?
They do. We haven't been able to learn exactly how much the Raiderettes bring into the Raiders, but there is information out about, for instance, the Dallas Cowboy cheerleaders, who bring in over $1 million to that team themselves, and they get paid $150 a game. And we believe that they also don't get paid for practices, et cetera. We think that what's happening in this instance is fairly consistent throughout the NFL with some variations.
And Lacey, you worked for the Golden State Warriors, right? And you had a different experience?
A much different experience. For one, in the way that they paid me, I felt appreciated and valued at the organization. They paid me for every single hour I worked. They reimbursed every travel expense I had for any event that I attended. I had zero out-of-pocket expenses. And most importantly, I received a paycheck every 2 weeks, which is a big help. It is known that it's a part-time job. But even so, I felt like I was making money, my time was valued, and it was fun. So there was a big, big difference in the NFL and the NBA.
Right. And Leslie Levy, is there a difference in terms of the law when it comes to full-time and part-time work? Because
No. This
is explicitly a part-time job.
No, there isn't. Minimum wage is minimum wage. Getting paid every 2 weeks is a requirement of the law. Being reimbursed for business expenses, all of those things apply whether it's a part-time job or a full-time job. The difference may come in some of the overtime that is owed, et cetera. But in California, you're owed overtime after 8 hours a day. And game days, in which they're paying these women $125, are 10-hour days for them.
And what will happen if you win your lawsuit in terms of how it might affect the rest of the NFL?
Well, our hope and Lacey's hope in stepping forward on this is that the Raiders and any other NFL team whose contract is in violation of the law will bring themselves into compliance with the law. And if they won't do so voluntarily, our lawsuit requests that the court stop them from continuing to use contracts that violate the law. So our hope is that these women will get paid at least minimum wage, if not ideally what they do deserve to be paid, and they'll be paid in accordance with the law in terms of the frequency and the amount. And
right.
That hopefully it will go nationwide.
All right. Leslie Levy, she's a lawyer representing the Raiderette plaintiffs in the lawsuit against the Raiders. We also heard from one of the Raiderettes, the lead plaintiff, Lacey T. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, another potentially landmark education lawsuit this time would upend the rules for firing public school teachers in California. We'll get a preview after news with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Coming up, going to the Grammys with our own insider, Jason Bentley. First, though, a potentially landmark case begins today in Los Angeles. Hillel Aaron is covering it for the Los Angeles Weekly, and he joins us now. Hi there.
Hello.
All right. The suit is called Vergara v. California, and it would, as I understand it, potentially rewrite the rules for hiring and firing public school teachers. Is that right?
Yeah, mostly firing, but yes.
Okay, tell us more about it and who's bringing it.
It's brought about by this nonprofit group called Students Matter, not to be confused with Students First, which is Michelle Rhee's school reform organization. This one is paid for by this rich guy named David Welch, and it's brought about on behalf of nine plaintiffs, including one of this high school girl whose last name is Vergara.
And what are they saying? What is the basis of their lawsuit?
Well, they're saying that five education laws in California are unconstitutional, including the law that says teachers have to be laid off in order of their seniority, which is sometimes called last in, first out. And they're also targeting the law that says all teachers are eligible for tenure after teaching for only 18 months. And three other laws that make it a long and onerous process to dismiss a teacher.
And they're saying that this is unfair to poor students. Why?
They're saying that I think they're saying it's unfair to all students, but it disproportionately affects poor students because oftentimes the bad teachers in the system are schuffled around and they end up landing in low-income school districts.
And then it's just really hard to get rid of them.
Exactly.
Okay, and this has been a 2-year in the making lawsuit, I understand.
Yeah.
And so it could potentially undermine union protections.
Yeah,
for
if
teachers.
This lawsuit does get found in favor of the plaintiffs, it will be the biggest thing to happen to California education since Prop 13. It will completely rewrite the rules of for like you said, for firing teachers. It'll be enormous consequences, and it could even have consequences across the country where other people may follow suit. It's interesting to note that school reform often goes through the state legislature, but this is one of the trends that's been happening in California is because they haven't had that much success in the legislature, they've been moving to the courts, and so if they're successful, other states may follow that lead.
So is this just a covert union-busting lawsuit?
Is it union-busting? Well, that's what unions would say, absolutely. I think that school reformers, some of whom I think have real genuine concerns, say that they like teachers, they like unions, they just think that teachers have gotten laws passed to make it too hard to run effective school districts.
And then I understand on the list of witnesses is John Daisy.
Yeah, he should be one of the first witnesses. He could even go up today.
And so he would be a witness for the plaintiffs.
Exactly.
Arguing against these rules.
Yeah, and it's funny because of the last big education lawsuit was actually Doe versus Daisy, where Daisy was named as one of the defendants, but he actually testified in that trial sort of against, in favor of the plaintiffs, which led some people to call it Daisy v. Daisy.
Mm. Well, as L.A. schools chief, he's got to really walk a fine line here, right, John Daisy?
We'll see. I'm not sure he will walk a fine line. He doesn't really make it a secret, what he thinks should happen to education. He's essentially a committed reformer. So
But he has gotten into trouble in the past for going too far in the anti-union camp, right?
Yeah,
he almost lost his job.
Over trouble. He's definitely caused some. He's ruffled some feathers, but they haven't fired him yet.
Right, right. So the unions are saying, look, it's not just about bad teachers that contribute to a poor student's outcome. There are a whole host of other things, right?
Exactly.
They'll say things like
that neighborhood is the number one determining factor in a student's success, and you can't pin this all on a teacher. Furthermore, they'll say that it actually helps when you give teachers tenure because they get more experienced, and a more experienced teacher is a better teacher.
Okay, so the first day of this trial begins today, and it is potentially a big deal.
It's a huge deal. It is a huge deal if it passes, or if it goes through, if it doesn't go through, because this will be sort of a marker to say you can't go this far in the court.
And again, this is not a jury trial. This
right,
trial will be determined by
a judge.
The
judge has the decision.
Okay. And how long is the trial expected to go on?
They've scheduled the trial for 20 days.
20 days.
Which is basically a month.
All right. Well, I guess you'll be busy. Hello.
I will.
Khalil Aaron of the LA Weekly, covering the opening arguments of today's potentially landmark case, Vergara versus California, which could completely rewrite the rules for hiring and most notably firing public school teachers. Thanks, Khalil.
Thanks, Madeline, and congrats on the new show.
Thank you. I just never get sick of that song. Get Lucky, the song of the night at the Grammys, as performed by Daft Punk, Stevie Wonder, and Macklemore and Ryan Lewis, here to talk about the Grammys and what relevance they have the day after, is our own Jason Bentley, who, by the way, was a board member of the Recording Academy, right, which runs the Grammys.
It is good to be a robot, apparently. five Grammy Awards last night for Daft Punk.
That's amazing, yeah. Including Record and Album of the Year. Are you surprised? Isn't that a traditional rock band outfit?
Sure. Winning? Well, I'm just happy for them. You know, we've supported them here at KCRW for such a long time. Yeah. And then personally, my connection to them presenting their first DJ set in Santa Monica at a very small club called The Pink for 125 people. So we've been friends for a long time, and it was just really special to see them on the Grammy stage.
Do they ever take those head helmet things off?
Well, yes, I know them before they were robots. The robots came along around 2006.
I see. And yeah. And because the robots are cool? They
just
like robots?
Well, they're huge fans of pop culture. So I think they really love to create a kind of mythology for what they do. And they're very shrewd.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, here's Paul Williams accepting Album of the Year because they didn't speak last night on stage, at least.
The, you know, back when I was drinking and using, I used to imagine things that weren't there that were frightening. And then I got sober and two robots called me and asked me to make an album.
All right. So yeah, that's cute. It's funny. So, you know, there were also a lot of old time music people there. Sir Paul McCartney, Ringo Starr, Metallica. Yeah. I think Led Zeppelin won an award.
Yeah, I'm not sure if they did, actually. They're certainly nominated.
Yeah. And so I'm wondering, you know, people criticize the Grammys and the recording industry for being a little old school with this presentation, with this show. I know it is the biggest night in music, but and there was a little, I don't know, dissatisfaction with Macklemore winning for best rap album as well, in a category with Jay-Z and Kanye West and Kendrick Lamar.
Well, you know, it's easy to knock the Grammys. It's easy to knock the big dog.
Right.
But they do an amazing job with so many different kinds of music. If you can imagine having to cover everything from Zydeco to Hawaiian music to the latest pop artist and newcomers like Lorde. So that's the great challenge. And also the thing you got to appreciate is there's a difference between the awards show and what the Recording Academy does every other day of the year. Their education initiatives, Grammy in the schools, Music Cares, their advocacy. There is just a lot more to it. And unless you're involved, you might not appreciate that. Now, certainly, the TV show is the greatest revenue generator for the Recording Academy, rumored to be $20 million a year. Through CBS, their partner, for another 5 years. So that is important.
And what do they spend that money on?
Well, everything that they're doing in terms of education, advocacy, and networking, and supporting the music and the culture that, you know, this whole economy thrives on. So, you know, their role is very important. I have, you know, personally been to Grammy on Capitol Hill. In terms of their advocacy, in terms of artist rights and copyright issues and things like that. So They do great work, and I believe they strike a great balance between the kind of legacy artists that you're talking about, the Willie Nelsons, and, you know, seeing Ringo Starr and Paul McCartney on stage together was really special.
Yeah.
But also making room for newcomers like Lord, who, you know, are these new generation artists that are becoming successful through YouTube and online and kind of finding their own audience without a record label.
Right, and Lord has been championed here.
Yes.
Yeah, KCRW.
Yeah, of course, we were one of the first station in the States to play Lord.
Now, I'm wondering, though, she is 17 years old, famously 17 years old.
Yeah.
Is it too much too soon? You know, last year's flavor was Gautier, and
that's right.
Where is he now?
That's right. Well, probably making a record. Trying to write a hit at this very moment. No, it's true. You know, these days we see these artists that are potentially just a flash in the pan. And that's one of the challenges for the Grammy Awards is, you know, will this be a lasting, enduring artist? Because, you know, it's easy to dismiss the labels and everything that they did. But when you think about it, all the details and the expertise in those halls, art direction, A&R, marketing, promotion, these are valuable resources and some very smart people working on developing your career. And so without that, I'm not so sure that these artists will really have a big future.
But then you heard Macklemore, he actually said this on stage, and I was wondering if this elicited some raised eyebrows, that he didn't go through the industry. He released his album on his own, he said.
Yeah.
So what do you make of that?
It's a wild west these days, and nobody has the answer. We don't know exactly where it's going. You have Beyonce, who, of course, has the luxury of being one of the biggest artists in the world, but she released her album with no notice, just out of the blue, it came out, her recent album.
That's right.
So we're seeing a lot of changes. We're seeing music streaming services where people subscribe to a whole menu of music. And it's really changing. It's the digital revolution. And so it's interesting to see how the Grammy Awards, of course, you know, they take the name from the gramophone.
Exactly.
And
they give you a little gramophone as a prize.
You know, how are they adapting to all of these changes? But you mentioned Macklemore and Lewis, and that was certainly one of the highlights of the show last night, where they married 33 couples in sort of support of marriage equality.
Right. And actually, we have a clip of tape from that. Queen Latifah presiding over the ceremony.
We are gathered here to celebrate love and harmony in every key, in every color. As I look out on this audience, I'm delighted to see the faces of 33 couples who've chosen this moment to celebrate their vows with us here in Los Angeles, and everyone watching around the world as witnesses.
Okay, so you have a kind of insider perspective as a former member of the Recording Academy. So did you know this was going to go down, or was it a surprise?
Yeah. They promoted it. And, you know, it was a real leap of faith for the Grammys, and I applaud them. You know, they strive to have these Grammy moments, these kind of water cooler conversation moments, and that was certainly one.
Right. And I'm just wondering, it's the day after, and for someone like Lord, what is the value of having a Grammy? She's already a huge star.
Well, it's only been a year, really, since we premiered her music here at KCRW, and here she is on the Grammy stage about a year later. So it's further awareness. You definitely see a sales bump in the days afterwards. I think the one that really scored and for whatever reason resonated was John Legend, and his performance of All of Me solo piano was just intimate and special.
It was beautiful.
And, you know, that actually is the takeaway for me, is the understated cool of the 56th annual Grammy Awards. It was just confident and the aesthetic was strong. It was a great night.
Jason Bentley, a fan, off to get some sleep after being up all night.
Yeah.
I won't finish that sentence. Okay, let's go out on Lord. And I'll talk to you later.
I'm not proud of my dress. In the torn up town, no postcode envy. But every song's like gold teeth, gray goose, dripping in the bathroom, blood stains, ball gowns, dressed in a hotel room. We don't.
We're driving Cadillacs in our dreams.
But everybody's like,
Chris, thou Maybach.
Diamonds on your timepiece.
Jeplings,
islands.
Tigers on a gold leash.
We don't care.
We aren't caught up in your love affair.
All right. We have Warren Olney here to give us a little update in 15 minutes, a little less than 15 minutes from now, to the point.
Hi. Well, first of all, just let me say congratulations on getting your show on the air.
Thank you, Warren.
It is wonderful to have you here at
KCRW.
You're a terrific colleague, and we're all looking forward very much to great shows now and in the future. On To the Point, what we're going to be talking about is Ukraine, a country we call the man in the middle, caught between the European Union and Vladimir Putin's Russia, not just geographically, but economically and politically, now on the verge of falling apart, with implications that could be very serious for the European Union, certainly for Vladimir Putin, and even for the United States.
Okay, well, we will look forward to that in less than 15 minutes from now on To the Point with Warren Olney. Thank you so much.
Okay.
All right. And coming up, our own Matt Miller is here to talk politics and preview President Obama's big speech tomorrow, the State of the Union. That's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
I'm Madeline Brand, and you're listening to a brand new radio show. It's called Press Play here on KCRW. Well, a year into his second term, President Obama is struggling with low approval ratings there, somewhere in the low 40s. And among the dings, the botched health care law rollout, the NSA spying scandal, some dithering delay and inaction on Syria. So tomorrow evening, he'll deliver his State of the Union address, and can he use it to turn things around? Joining me now, syndicated columnist and another member of the KCRW family, Matt Miller. Hi, Matt.
Hey, Madeline, and congratulations.
Well, thank you. It's nice to hear you on the other side of the mic. All right, well, let's get right into it. And, you know, last year, the president used his speech to call for gun control and immigration reform, and really not that much was done on those fronts. What is he expected to push for tomorrow night?
Well, you know, what the White House is talking about, and I'm kind of sighing heavily because obviously he had a terrible year, and none of the big things he talked about happened. Then he had the botched rollout, as you said, of Obamacare, which continues to linger. The White House is talking a lot about the so-called, quote, the pen and the phone strategy. He may not control the Congress because the House Republicans will try and block many things, as will the Senate Republicans, who can still filibuster most things. But he's got the power of the pen. He can do executive orders. He can convene people via the phone. And so, you know, they're leaking things like he's going to announce commitments by a number of major American corporations not to discriminate against the long-term unemployed in their hiring decisions, because that's such a big problem now, as we all know. But it's pretty thin gruel. So I think for people who are hoping for, bold initiatives.
We're not going to hear that.
Obama's almost, no, I don't
Plus
think.
Plus, it's a midterm
election. They'll be bold rhetoric.
Here. Yeah. The midterms as well. So there's going to be a lot of politicking around it. You had a really good idea, though, in your column and your recent column, and that revolves around the number 15. Can you outline it briefly?
Sure. Well, I thought since all of Obama's earlier State of the Union phrases kind of vanished into the ether, you know, an America built to last, things like that. He keeps packaging slogans that kind of disappear the day after, kind of like my daughter's photos on Snapchat. But we don't need Snapchat, State of the Union. So I thought he should take a page from Herman Cain, who had that famous 999 plan, which
he was the pizza guy who ran for president.
Exactly. And so not a man to be taken seriously, I think, but someone who knew something about marketing and ideas that would stick. And everybody knew he had this 999 tax plan. So I thought the number 15 would work to the power of 15 would work for Obama to hook a lot of initiatives around, or goals that he could be calling the nation toward, like $15 an hour as a minimum reward for full-time work, getting health costs down to 15% of GDP, because they're at 18 now. Every other advanced nations is at 10 to 12. you know, and everyone's struggling under these costs, even if they're getting expanded coverage under Obamacare. 15% corporate taxes, lower corporate taxes, boost jobs, appeal across the aisle, et cetera. And a few other things. Lower the voting age to 15. One of my most subversive ideas, I guess, because I think the younger generation is getting screwed in so many ways by the current trends from both parties that a movement to lower the voting age, even if it didn't happen, and you know, you could say 16 might be better than 15. 15's a little young. I have a 16-year-old, so I'm prepared to give her the vote. But it would be a hook for the news media to cover all the generational aspects of climate change, the budget, all these unfunded pension liabilities that we're really leaving to kids.
Well, let's talk a little bit about income inequality and sort of this idea that this is the thing that he really wants to address in the last few years of his presidency. And how much traction is he going to be able to get with that and do anything to address it with a Republican Congress?
I think there are actually two separate questions what you asked. I think he can get a lot of traction with it because this issue now resonates. You know, polls show now that Republican voters, by large majorities, support increases in the minimum wage. So the idea that, you know, the very top are getting most of the benefits from this economy and lots of people are struggling resonates across the aisle. What I fear, though, is that not much actually will happen, in part because of Republican opposition to some of the measures he might propose, but also because the Democrats have become very good in a way that I think is not good for the country at using big rhetoric but not matching that with ambitious policy proposals. So they show which side they're on and that the other side's not on that side, but they can win elections this way without actually proposing and enacting policies that are anywhere close to the magnitude of the challenges we face. And I think that's a seductive trap that Democrats now face. And I think we're going to see that on display in spades from his speech tomorrow. Well, there'll be lots of big themes. It may gin up the base for the midterms, but I think we'll see very little actually accomplished, which is the case except for expanded health coverage for the whole of Obama's two terms.
Right, right. Well, you know, I mean, he always blames, and to some extent, it's a fair argument that he's been unable to get traction because the Republicans keep, you know, stopping him from getting anything done, so that there really isn't a lot that he can get done in, you know, sort of broad strokes, that he has to do this little piecemeal approach to stuff because he just can't get any agreement on the other side.
Well, here's my reaction to that. It's obviously true in one sense, but that doesn't explain, you know, Republican intransigence doesn't explain the timidity of Democratic proposals. So we have a situation for several years where we've had around 20 million people who want full-time work who can't find it. The Jobs Act that Obama proposed, even though it had no chance to go anywhere a couple of years ago, would have at most produced 1 to 2 million jobs over a couple of years. If you think you can't get something passed through a Republican Congress anyway, why on earth wouldn't you propose something equal to the challenge that's big enough to maybe inspire people and, you know, campaign across the country for something that's a big challenge? Health costs is the same thing. Those are, you know, eating up all the money that would have gone to raises because corporations bear these costs. And if health costs keep exploding, they can't offer people raises. And yet Obama, the Republicans aren't any better, but they won't go after the health care monopolies in local markets that are driving prices up. So I think in all these things, it lets off Obama and the Democrats too easily to say it's all Republican opposition, because if Democrats aimed higher, at least there'd be a chance to try and re-scramble the politics. At least I think so.
All right. Matt Miller, it's so great to talk to you. Thank you. Thank you for your wisdom.
Congrats again for your debut.
Okay. Thank you. Talk to you soon. Time now to end the show with a regular segment. We're going to look at the mailbag with producer Jolie Myers, and the goal is to have this an everyday occurrence.
Yeah, Madeline. So, I'll be going over the feedback at the end of every day's show.
Excellent.
I had a blast live tweeting the show today and interacting with everyone that was shouting out to us with congratulations and everything.
So nice.
It was really good.
So gratifying.
At KCRW Press Play. Follow
us. Wait till tomorrow, though.
right. The hate mail.
We get the hate tweet.
We also take your voicemails, and we have an inaugural voicemail from Paul.
I have a question about the title of the show. Is this press play, as in to play music? Or is this a press play, as in a play on press? Or a press play, as in a full court press on the issues of the day? Thanks.
And to answer Paul's question, yes.
All three and
all
more.
All of those things.
Whatever you want it to be.
We decided to get real clever with the name. And what they don't tell you is that naming a new show is almost as hard as naming a child.
It is.
We agonized over this. Paul, I'm glad that you got our joke. Thank you very much. And if you want to leave a voicemail, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY. Give us a call. You might hear yourself on air. And we talked about firsts at the top of the show today.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we had somebody, a guy named Kel Killian, left his first on our Facebook page. He said it was his first day as a barista in Santa Monica in the 90s. He was commuting from Anaheim during a rainstorm, rookie mistake, tried to take surface streets, showed up 3 hours late, soaking wet and completely traumatized on his first day. So I think we did okay today.
I think we did. Did he at least get a warm cup of coffee?
You know, he didn't tell us that. I'll have to follow up with him on our Facebook page. Joe Lamb also wants to know if we're podcasting. Of course, KCRW.com, iTunes, mobile app. Go get it.
Go get it. You can get it wherever. We're Facebook, we're Twitter, at KCRW Press Play. Also, at The Mad Brand is my handle. Jolie Myers, look forward to hearing from you tomorrow.
Thanks, Madeline.
Thank you. All right, we will be back tomorrow to do this again. Up next, To the Point with Warren Olney. I'm Madeline Brand. I will see you tomorrow.